Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Panerdy.
And today we are jumping straight into what might honestly be the most packed 48 hours of federal government activity we have ever tried to track. The sheer amount of news and, frankly, the constitutional weight of it all is just staggering.
You're absolutely right about that. We're calling this Deep Dive the federal news update for Monday, September 23rd, 2025.
Right. Because since the clock started ticking on Monday morning, September 22nd, we have seen this extraordinary flood of actions coming out of the White House, the courts, and, well, what's not happening in Congress is almost as important.
Exactly. Our mission today really is to give you a detailed, truly comprehensive, and frankly exhaustive look at every single significant action and activity across the U.S. federal government since that moment. We've got a lot to cover.
Yeah, we really do. And our goal isn't just to list off the policies, you know, the new Tylenol guidance or that unbelievable H-1B fee hike.
Yeah.
It's more about understanding why this specific moment feels different. This convergence of moves impacting constitutional law, public health, national security, all at once.
Yeah.
It feels less like policy tweaking and more like, I don't know, rapid structural change.
That's a great way to put it. Structural change. And to understand that, you really have to start with the engine driving a lot of this, which is the executive branch. The last couple of days have been marked by some very, very ideologically driven policy directives coming straight from the top.
Okay, so let's start with maybe the most provocative one. The designation of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization.
Yeah, that landed on Monday, September 22nd. President Trump signed an executive order making it official.
And the language in that order, it wasn't subtle, was it? What exactly did it say to justify this kind of move?
No, not subtle at all. The order labels Antifa a, quote, militarist anarchist enterprise that explicitly calls for the overthrow of the U.S. government, law enforcement authorities, and our system of law, end quote. That's very strong language, clearly designed to remove any perceived political legitimacy.
And beyond the label, what does the order actually do? What does it tell agencies to focus on?
Well, it directs all the relevant federal agencies, think DOJ, FBI, DHS, to use their, quote, full authorities to investigate, disrupt, and dismantle Antifa operations. That's a pretty sweeping mandate.
But Antifa isn't like, you know, ISIS or Al-Qaeda. It's not a formal group with a headquarters and a membership list. How do you dismantle something that's more of an ideology or a movement? That seems tricky.
That is the critical legal question, right? And the order tries to address that by specifically targeting funding and material support networks. That suggests the administration wants to go beyond just individuals involved in protests or clashes.
So they could be looking at activist groups, maybe even nonprofits or PAYS they see as supporting left-wing causes.
That seems to be the implication. Conflating support for certain political causes with material support for terrorism, it's a very fine and legally dangerous line to draw.
And the timing here, it felt incredibly deliberate. This came right after the memorial for Charlie Kirk, the conservative activist killed on September 10th. The administration directly linked the order to his killing.
Explicitly. They blamed radical left-wing political violence and used the killing as the primary catalyst for the designation.
But, and this is crucial, have authorities actually presented any evidence linking the suspected shooter in the Kirk case to Antifa?
That's the disconnect. So far, zero evidence has been presented publicly linking the suspect to Antifa or any related group. So many legal experts are looking at this and saying, look, this designation was something the administration wanted to do anyway. The tragic killing provided a politically useful but factually questionable justification to push it through.
Okay, let's talk about the legal side more broadly. Why is it so much harder, constitutionally speaking, to designate a domestic group as terrorist compared to a foreign one?
It boils down to the First Amendment. Congress set up a specific legal process for designating foreign terrorist organizations, FTOs. But they deliberately didn't create a parallel system for domestic groups.
Why not?
Because of the protections for free speech, assembly, and political association. The idea is to prevent the government from essentially outlawing a political ideology, even one it considers extreme or dangerous. You target criminal acts, not the underlying beliefs or affiliations.
And we heard former FBI Director Wray describe Antifa not as a formal organization, but as a decentralized movement, right? Doesn't that make this designation even harder to enforce legally?
Absolutely. The legal footing is, well, extremely tenuous. How do you prosecute someone for affiliation with an entity that has no formal structure, no membership roles? It's very problematic.
So is this less about actual prosecutions and more about sending a signal?
It functions much more powerfully as a political directive to the DOJ and the FBI. It tells them investigating left-wing activism is now a top priority, and, you know, it creates a very clear contrast.
A contrast with how the administration has dealt with right-wing groups.
Okay.
Particularly those involved in January 6th.
Exactly. You have this aggressive move against Antifa, framing left-wing protests broadly as terrorism, while at the same time the administration has issued pardons for individuals linked to groups like the Proud Boys who were involved in the Capitol attack. It paints a picture of highly selective enforcement based on political alignment. It certainly mobilizes the president's base, giving them a clear enemy.
Okay, let's shift gears completely now. Also on Monday, the executive branch rolled out a very different but equally controversial initiative focused on public health. This one involves acetaminophen Tylenol and a supposed link to autism.
Yes, this was a major announcement delivered from the Roosevelt Room. It was framed as a response to what the administration called a national autism epidemic. President Trump, alongside HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., made a direct, quite forceful recommendation.
What was the recommendation?
That pregnant women should significantly limit their use of acetaminophen. Tylenol, basically.
And the president himself added a personal plea, didn't he? Something about toughing it out.
He did. He urged pregnant women to, quote, fight like hell not to take it, suggesting they should tough it out unless facing an extremely high fever. That's putting a lot of pressure on expectant mothers, considering Tylenol is one of the very few painkillers generally considered safe during pregnancy.
And this isn't just talk, right? There are regulatory actions planned.
Correct. HHS is launching a nationwide public service campaign. And critically, FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry announced the FDA is taking action based on data they, quote, cannot ignore. They plan to issue a formal notice to physicians and start the process for a safety label change on acetaminophen products.
A label change saying what specifically?
The proposed label would state that Tylenol can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. That's a direct quote from the announcement.
Wow. Okay, but the reaction from doctors, from medical groups, was immediate and strong, wasn't it? They don't seem to agree with this link.
No, the pushback was swift and pretty unified. The core message from the medical establishment is that the existing scientific consensus simply does not support a causal link between acetaminophen use during pregnancy and autism or ADHD.
What are their main concerns with this administration announcement?
Two big things, really. First, the science itself. The Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, SMFM, came out right away saying their own thorough review of all the research hasn't established that causal relationship. Former FDA head Scott Gottlieb basically echoed that worth studying maybe, but no clear evidence for this kind of immediate high impact action, like a label change that could cause panic.
Okay, so scientific validity is one concern. What's the second?
It's the potential negative consequences if pregnant women do follow the advice to just tough it out. What happens if they avoid Tylenol?
They might suffer through high fevers, which aren't good for the baby either.
Exactly. Prolonged high fevers are known to pose risks during pregnancy. Or maybe even worse, women might turn to other painkillers like ibuprofen or aspirin, which carry much clearer, well-established risks, like miscarriage or birth defects. So the medical consensus is basically the known risks of avoiding Tylenol for necessary pain or fever relief likely outweigh the unproven risks of taking it responsibly.
And the president didn't stop at Tylenol, did he? He also waded into vaccine schedules.
He did. He suggested personal changes to the standard childhood vaccine schedule based purely on, quote, what he feels is best.
Like what specific changes?
He suggested parents should wait until age 12 for the hepatitis B vaccine and also advocated for spacing out other shots more, arguing against, you know, loading up babies with multiple vaccines in one visit.
Which goes directly against CDC and pediatrician recommendations.
That's right.
Especially on Hep B.
Completely contradicts standard guidance. The hepatitis B recommendation is particularly concerning from a medical standpoint because the virus can be transmitted from mother to infant at birth. If that happens, the baby has a very high risk of developing chronic liver disease later in life. That's precisely why early vaccination, starting at birth, is the standard of care.
Okay. Alongside all this, there was one specific regulatory move related to autism treatment, something involving leucovorin.
Yes. CMS Administrator Mehmet Oz announced they are restoring approval for welcovorin, which is leucovorin, a form of B vitamin, for treating autism symptoms.
How does that connect to the Tylenol announcement?
It shows how the policy pieces link up. Because the FDA is moving towards this Tylenol label change, warning about autism risk, it creates an opening, politically and regulatorily, to promote alternative approaches or treatments for autism.
And making it easier to prescribe Welcovorin.
Right. Because of this approval change, state Medicaid programs, which cover more than half of all kids in the U.S., will now have to cover prescriptions for Welcovorin when prescribed for autism symptoms. It does two things at once. It gives some parents access to a treatment they might want, even if it's controversial scientifically, and it allows for widespread data collection on its use and potential effects across a huge population, policy and research bundled together.
Okay, so we've seen the executive branch making major moves on domestic security and public health. Now let's pivot to the judiciary, because there was a development there that some are calling a potential constitutional earthquake.
That's not an exaggeration. On Monday, September 22nd, the Supreme Court made a huge announcement. They agreed to hear arguments this coming December on potentially overturning a really old, really foundational precedent called Humphrey's Executor v. United States. It dates back to 1935.
90 years old. Okay, for listeners maybe not deep in administrative law, why is Humphrey's Executor such a big deal? Give us the quick version of why it matters so much for how the federal government works.
Think about agencies like the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, or the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, or the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. These are independent agencies. They have powers that are sort of like making laws and sort of like judging cases within their specific areas. To do that job effectively, based on expertise and not just politics, they need some independence from the president.
And Humphrey's Executor provides that independence.
Exactly. It's the legal firewall. The ruling said the president cannot just fire the commissioners of these independent agencies whenever he wants. He can only remove them for specific, proven reasons like misconduct or neglect of duty. It shields them from raw political pressure, allowing them to be, well, independent.
But the court didn't just agree to hear the case later. They took an immediate action related to it, didn't they? Concerning an FTC commissioner.
They did, and it was a pretty stunning move. In a 6-3 vote, the court granted the administration's request to allow President Trump to fire a Democratic FTC commissioner, Rebecca Slaughter, immediately, even though the main case about overturning Humphreys is still pending.
So they let the firing happen before deciding the underlying legal question. What does that signal?
It signals quite a lot about where the majority might be leaning. By allowing the removal now, they're essentially acting as if Humphreys might not apply anymore. Justice Kagan, in her dissent for the three liberal justices, basically said the court is handing over control of these agencies to the president piece by piece through these stay orders without even waiting for the full arguments.
The administration's argument for overturning Humphreys relies heavily on something called the unitary executive theory. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. The unitary executive theory is the idea that Article 2 of the Constitution gives all executive power solely to the president. The argument goes like this. If an official is exercising significant executive power, which the heads of these independent agencies definitely do, then the president must have complete control over them, including the power to fire them at will.
Why must he have that power, according to the theory?
The DOJ argues the president needs unchecked removal authority to ensure that these officials faithfully execute the laws in the way he interprets that duty. Solicitor General Sauer argued that the government itself is harmed when executive power is held by officers the president can't directly control and fire.
So if the court actually overturns Humphrey's Executor in December, what are the practical implications? You use the word earthquake.
It would fundamentally reshape the federal government. The leaders of dozens of independent agencies, the SEC regulating markets, the FCC handling communications, the National Labor Relations Board overseeing labor disputes, all of them could suddenly be subject to at-will firing by the president. If the president doesn't like a regulation they issue or enforcement action they take, boom, they could be gone instantly.
And the Federal Reserve. We keep mentioning its independence. What would this mean for the Fed?
It would be incredibly damaging. The entire global financial system relies on the perception that the Federal Reserve makes monetary policy decisions based on economic data and analysis, independent of short-term political pressure from the White House. If the Fed chair or the governors can be fired simply because the president dislikes their interest rate decisions, that perception shatters.
Which could spook markets?
Severely. It raises huge risks for economic stability, investor confidence, everything. Politicizing the Fed is seen by most economists as playing with fire. Overturning Humphrey's Executor could effectively ignite that fire.
Wow. Okay, this theme of expanding executive power enabled by the judiciary connects directly to another major executive action from this week, one with immediate huge economic consequences, especially for the tech industry, the H-1B visa fee.
Yeah, this was another bombshell announcement delivered by Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. The administration is imposing a massive new fee for H-1B visas, the ones often used for high-skilled tech workers.
How massive?
$100,000 per new applicant.
$100,000, is that annual?
No, it's specified as a one-time charge for the initial application. But still, $100,000 per hire is just astronomical. It's clearly punitive, not based on processing costs.
What was the administration's justification for such a drastic increase? Lutnick mentioned prioritizing American workers.
Right. The official line is that this fee is necessary to force companies to hire Americans first and to ensure the H-1B is only used for, quote, extraordinary people at the very top, arguing the program is currently widely abused.
But is that how the industry sees it? Or is this viewed more as an attack on tech and immigration?
The reaction suggests the latter. Reports described immediate panic and chaos in the tech sector and immigrant communities. Major U.S. tech companies warned it would cripple hiring. Indian IT firms, whose employees receive a large share of H-1Bs, saw their stock prices drop instantly. Analysts started calculating the impact on profits, potentially a 7 to 15% reduction in core operating profit for major U.S. tech firms just from this one change. It's essentially a massive tax on acquiring specialized talent.
And there's a real irony here, isn't there? Experts are predicting this won't actually protect American jobs, but might do the opposite.
Exactly. It could spectacularly backfire. The fear is a reverse brain drain.
Meaning what?
Meaning companies that need top-tier talent in AI, advanced engineering, biotech, R&D, if it suddenly costs $100,000 extra per person just to bring them to the U.S., those companies might just decide to move the jobs and the projects elsewhere, to places like Canada or India or Mexico, where the talent is available without this prohibitive fee. So instead of protecting U.S. jobs, it could accelerate offshoring of high-value innovation, eroding America's long-term competitiveness.
And just like the Antifa designation, this H-1B fee hike seems legally vulnerable right out of the gate.
Highly vulnerable. For a couple of key reasons. First, immigration law generally requires fees to be related to the actual cost of processing the application. A $100,000 fee looks punitive, not cost-based. Second, and perhaps more immediately, major policy changes like this usually require a public notice and comment period under the Administrative Procedure Act.
And this was implemented without that.
Seems so. It was announced as a proclamation, seemingly bypassing that standard regulatory process. Because it's such a major change with huge economic impact, that lack of notice and comment makes it ripe for immediate legal challenges and, likely, court injunctions to block it.
Okay, so we have executive actions, judicial shifts enabling them, and now this desire to control not just policy, but also information flow. That brings us to the Pentagon and new restrictions on the press.
That's right. News emerged that the Pentagon circulated a pretty lengthy memo, 17 pages, outlining new rules for credentialed journalists working in the building.
What's the core change?
The most controversial part is a requirement for journalists to sign a pledge. A pledge not to report information that hasn't been officially authorized for release by the Pentagon, even if that information is unclassified.
Even if it's unclassified. So information that isn't secret, but maybe just politically inconvenient.
That seems to be the implication, yes.
And the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, he didn't exactly try to soften this, did he?
Not at all. He was very blunt in public statements. He said things like, the press does not run the Pentagon, and the press is no longer allowed to roam the halls of a secure facility. He basically said journalists need to wear a badge, stick to very strict rules, maybe even require escorts, or they can just go home.
How are press freedom groups reacting?
They're calling it an assault on independent journalism, a dangerous step towards government censorship. The concern is that it functions as a form of prior restraint, the government trying to control what gets published before it gets published. It severely limits reporters' ability to gather information independently and talk to sources, even about non-secret matters that are clearly in the public interest.
Okay, this whole discussion, unilateral executive power, potential constitutional shifts, controlling information, it loops us right back to the economy and the Federal Reserve, especially given that Humphrey's executor case potentially stripping its independence. And this week, we heard a significant speech from a Fed governor, Governor Mehran.
Yes, Governor Mehran gave his first major public speech since joining the Fed board, and he came out swinging, arguing that the Fed's current monetary policy is way too tight.
Okay.
He put a number on it. Approximately 2 percentage points too tight meaning too restrictive. He argued this overly tight stance risks causing unnecessary job losses and pushing unemployment higher than it needs to be. That's a pretty stark criticism of the Fed's current path.
2 percentage points is a huge gap. What's his argument based on? He talked a lot about R-star, right?
Exactly. His whole analysis hinges on R-star, which is the theoretical neutral interest rate, the rate that neither speeds up nor slows down the economy. If the Fed's actual interest rate target is way above R-star, policy is restrictive. Mirren's core point is that R-star is probably much lower now than the Fed thinks, mainly due to some big, underappreciated structural changes in the economy that have happened recently, especially in 2025.
Okay, what are those big structural changes he pointed to?
He focused on three main things. First, immigration and border policy. He argued the shift from what was effectively open borders and high immigration levels to potentially negative net migration now is a huge deal for the labor force.
How does that lower R-star?
Fewer workers coming in means slower potential growth for the economy, slower population growth specifically. He estimated the expected drop in annual population growth from maybe 1% down to 0.4% translates directly into almost a 0.4 percentage point drop in R-star. Basically, less labor growth means less need for capital investment to keep up, which naturally lowers the neutral interest rate.
Okay, immigration is one factor. What was the second?
The second was tax legislation, specifically that big tax law passed earlier this year. Mirren cited estimates that this law will boost national saving by a massive $3.8 trillion over the next decade.
And how does more saving affect the neutral interest rate? He mentioned something called the Rachel Summers Channel.
Right. The Rachel Summers Channel is an economic theory suggesting that a big increase in national saving puts downward pressure on long-term interest rates, including R-star. If there's more money available to be saved and invested, the price of borrowing that money, the interest rate that balances everything out, should fall. Mirren argued this huge boost to saving implies about a half a percentage point reduction in R-star.
So immigration changes and the tax law are pushing R-star down significantly in his view. What was the third factor? Something about rent inflation.
Yes, the third piece was rent disinflation. This is a bit more technical. He pointed out that the way we measure inflation for rent in the official CPI figures lags behind what's actually happening in the rental market by about 18 months. So even though CPI rent inflation might still look high now, he said it's around 3.5% actual market rents have been falling. He expects that CPI measure for rent inflation will eventually drop way down, maybe below 1.5% by 2027. Because rent is a big chunk of overall inflation, this future drop, he argues, means overall inflation, measured by PCE, the Fed's preferred gauge, will likely be about 0.4 percentage points lower by 2028 than current projections suggest.
So that future expected drop in inflation also argues for lower interest rates now.
Exactly. It's another reason he thinks policy is too tight today. You need to account for that coming disinflation.
So adding it all up, the immigration effect, the tax law effect, the future rent disinflation, what did Governor Mirren actually recommend the Fed do?
He basically said the Fed needs to catch up to this new reality quickly. He argued they're risking slowing the economy down too much, creating an output gap, meaning the economy performs below its potential. His specific recommendation, a series of 50s.
Meaning 50 basis point cuts, yeah. Half a percentage point each time.
Yes, a series of aggressive 50 basis point rate cuts to get policy back towards this lower neutral rate much faster. He stressed it wasn't about reacting to some sudden economic crisis, but about recalibrating based on these fundamental structural shifts that he believes the rest of the Fed might be underappreciating.
It's fascinating to hear a Fed governor making such a data-driven case for policy independence at the exact same time we're seeing increased political pressure on supposedly independent bodies. That brings us to the Department of Justice.
Yeah, the contrast is stark, and we saw a very direct example of that pressure over the weekend. President Trump took to social media, publicly urging Attorney General Pam Bondi to prosecute several of his longstanding political adversaries.
Who did he name specifically?
He explicitly called for the prosecution of Senator Adam Schiff, former FBI Director James Comey, and New York Attorney General Letitia James.
And when the White House press office was asked about this, you know, whether it's appropriate for a president to publicly demand prosecutions of political rivals, whether it looks like retribution, and what did they say?
Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt pushed back hard. She framed it not as retribution or weaponization, but as demanding accountability for people she claimed had abused their office and abused their power. She specifically went after Letitia James, mentioning James's campaign promises to go after Trump, and even citing some report alleging mortgage fraud by James herself. The White House line is essentially, The DOJ was weaponized against Trump, and now it needs to be used to hold those people accountable. It's flipping the weaponization charge.
This climate of demanding loyalty and specific outcomes seems reflected in a recent controversial appointment within the DOJ structure itself.
It does. President Trump appointed Lindsey Halligan as the new U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia.
And why is that controversial?
Halligan was one of Trump's defense attorneys during his recent legal battles. Critically, she has essentially no prior experience as a prosecutor. Her background before joining Trump's team was mainly in insurance law. This appointment came after the previous U.S. attorney in that office resigned, amid reports he felt blocked from pursuing investigations the White House didn't like.
So, appointing a defense lawyer with no prosecutorial background to be a top federal prosecutor.
It sends a pretty clear signal. The president himself praised her, saying he needed a tough prosecutor there to, quote, get things moving. It suggests loyalty and alignment with the president's agenda might be prioritized over traditional qualifications for such a role.
And the White House also had to defend Tom Holman, the border czar, this week. Regarding an old FBI investigation.
Yes, reports resurfaced about an FBI bribery investigation from last year where Holman allegedly accepted a bag containing $50,000 cash from an undercover agent. The investigation was later closed.
How did the White House respond to those reports coming back up?
Carolyn Leavitt defended Holman vehemently. She claimed he never took the $50,000, despite reports saying he did initially accept the bag, and alleged the whole thing was a setup by the Biden DOJ to target a Trump supporter. She insisted Holman did nothing wrong and that the current FBI, under Director Kash Patel, reviewed it and found zero evidence of wrongdoing, essentially clearing him internally.
Okay, so you have all this assertive action from the executive branch, enabled perhaps by the judiciary, which leaves the third branch, Congress. And the story there seems to be the exact opposite. Paralysis.
Complete paralysis, yes. Especially critical now because the federal fiscal year ends on September 30th. We are staring down the barrel of a partial government shutdown, and it looks increasingly likely.
Why? What happened with the funding bills?
On Friday, the Senate basically hit a brick wall. It rejected both the Republican-proposed continuing resolution, CR, to keep the government funded, and the alternative proposed by the Democrats. Neither could get the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster.
Let's quickly break those down. What was in the Republican CR that the House managed to pass?
The House bill, H.R. 5371, passed very narrowly, 217 to 212. It would have funded the government through November 21st, mostly at current levels. But it had a couple of specific additions Republicans wanted. $30 million extra for security for Congress, linked to the Charlie Kirk killing, and a technical fix for a D.C. budget issue. But it didn't have Democratic priorities, so it was dead on arrival in the Senate due to the filibuster.
And the Democratic alternative, what do they propose?
Their version was for a shorter funding period, just through October 31st, trying to force faster negotiations on a full-year budget. Crucially, it included extensions for some Affordable Care Act health insurance subsidies that are about to expire, and it tried to reverse some recent Medicaid cuts. Those were non-starters for Republicans, so it failed too.
So, total gridlock. And now the House has made a move that seems designed to force the Senate's hand.
Exactly. In a pretty bold political play, the House leadership announced they're going into recess and won't even return to Washington until October.
What does that mean, practically?
It basically leaves the Senate holding the bag. The House is saying, we passed our bill, you either pass it too, or the government shuts down, and it's your fault. It forces the Senate Democrats into a corner. The Republicans' strategy is to paint Democrats as obstructing a clean funding bill, hoping they'll take the blame for a shutdown.
And how are Democrats responding to that pressure?
They seem unified for now. They're digging in, demanding real negotiations. They're pointing fingers back at the GOP, especially highlighting the failure to address those expiring ACA subsidies, saying Republicans are the ones risking healthcare access for millions right before an election. They're trying to put the blame squarely back on the GOP.
So this legislative paralysis, it's not just about the budget, is it? It plays into that larger theme of power dynamics.
Absolutely. It creates the perfect power vacuum. When Congress is gridlocked and can't act, it makes the executive branch look like the only part of government that can actually get things done, even if it's through unilateral orders and proclamations. A shutdown crisis isn't just a failure to pass a budget. It actively facilitates that shift of functional power towards the White House because Congress essentially takes itself out of the game.
Okay, even with Congress stuck, the regulatory agencies are still moving. Let's talk about some of the significant regulatory changes, starting with the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. They made some big moves on environmental reporting.
Yes, on September 22nd, the EPA released a major proposed rule. They want to permanently get rid of mandatory emissions reporting for almost all industrial sources under the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program, the GHGRP.
Wait, all sources? I thought GHGRP was the main way we track industrial pollution.
Almost all. They're proposing eliminating it for 46 out of the 47 currently covered industrial source categories. This program tracks emissions from over 8,000 major facilities across the U.S. Power plants, refineries, factories. It's widely considered the bedrock, the gold standard for understanding where greenhouse gas pollution comes from.
So why dismantle it? What's the EPA's reasoning?
The justification is explicitly deregulation and cost savings for industry. They directly cited President Trump's Executive Order 14192, the one titled Unleashing Prosperity Through Deregulation. They estimate that getting rid of this reporting will save industry somewhere between $2 billion and $2.4 billion over 10 years.
Okay, but what's the environmental impact? What do critics say we lose if this data disappears?
Critics are calling it a massive step backward. It essentially blinds the country to its major sources of climate pollution. You eliminate the tracking for almost everything. You lose the ability to see trends, to target reductions effectively, or even to hold polluters accountable. The old saying applies, you can't manage what you can't measure. It basically shifts the burden entirely onto individual states, many of which don't have the resources or the political will to replicate this kind of detailed tracking. It creates a huge national data gap.
And the EPA didn't stop there, right? They also proposed changes to how they review chemical safety.
Correct. Also on September 22nd, they proposed narrowing the scope of safety reviews for existing chemicals under the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA.
Narrowing how? What specifically would change?
Yeah. They want to undo some regulations put in place during the Biden administration. Those rules required the EPA, when reviewing a high-priority chemical, to consider all the ways people might be exposed to it through air, water, consumer products in the workplace, etc., and all the potential health effects. The new proposal would allow EPA to ignore certain exposure pathways or uses.
And it adds some assumptions about workers using protective gear.
Yes, that's a key controversial part. The proposed rule would add assumptions into the safety reviews, primarily that workers in occupational settings are consistently and correctly using personal protective equipment, or PPE. Critics worry this assumption doesn't reflect reality in many workplaces and will lead EPA to systematically underestimate the actual risks workers face, making it easier to approve or allow continued use of potentially harmful chemicals.
Okay, so EPA moving towards deregulation. But on the energy front, we saw FERAC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, move in the opposite direction towards more regulation for grid security.
That's right. A contrasting move. FERC finalized a significant new rule aimed at boosting the security and reliability of the U.S. electric grid.
How? What does the rule require?
It requires electric utilities to develop and implement much more robust supply chain risk management plans, or SCRM plans. The goal is to protect the power grid from national security threats that could come from malicious software or counterfeit hardware embedded in the equipment utilities buy from the global supply chain, things like routers, control systems, transformers. It expands the scope of equipment covered compared to previous rules.
Makes sense. Now, shifting to the federal workforce itself, we heard about some agencies having staffing issues, but also some reversals. Like at GSA?
Yes, it shows some of the turbulence within the administration's workforce policies. The General Services Administration, GSA, which manages federal buildings, is now reportedly looking to rehire hundreds of employees that had previously laid off from its public building service, PBS.
Why the reversal? Weren't they trying to shrink the federal real estate footprint?
They were, and they implemented significant layoffs earlier. But it seems they might have cut too deep too fast. This reversal comes after reports that many experienced employees felt pressured into taking early retirement offers under duress. Some said mainly to keep their health insurance because they feared being laid off later without it. Now, GSA seems to realize they need some of those people back to actually manage the remaining properties and operations effectively.
And other agencies are also scrambling to keep staff, like the IRS and DOL.
Yeah, there are definitely signs of strain. Government watchdogs have been raising alarms about staffing shortages, particularly at the IRS, potentially impacting next year's tax filing season. We're seeing reports that both the IRS and the Department of Labor are now rescinding previously approved deferred resignation offers.
Meaning they're telling people who plan to leave later that they have to stay.
Essentially, yes. trying to plug critical vacancies. It highlights the impact of previous workforce reduction efforts and hiring freezes under this administration. The IRS, for instance, reportedly lost over a quarter of its staff. Pulling back resignation offers is a pretty clear sign they're struggling to fill essential roles needed for basic functions like processing returns and enforcement.
One last workforce item, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, announced something about reimbursable services. What's that about?
Right. CBP announced new awards under its Reimbursable Services Program, or RSP. This is an interesting setup, basically a public-private partnership.
How does it work?
It allows private companies like an airline, an airport authority, a seaport operator, or even other government agencies to essentially pay CBP extra money to get additional inspection services beyond what CBP provides through its regular budget. This could mean more customs officers, more immigration inspectors, or agricultural specialists at a specific port of entry during peak times, for example.
So companies can pay for faster processing. Doesn't that create inequity?
That's the potential concern, and CBP emphasized the safeguards. The program is strictly controlled, they say, to ensure that these extra paid-for services are purely augmenting existing services and do not degrade the level of service provided to everyone else who isn't paying extra. It's supposed to be additive only.
Got it. Okay, that covers the regulatory and workforce beat. Let's wrap up by looking at defense, security, and especially the accelerating adoption of technology, particularly AI, across the government.
Certainly. And first, on the defense front, we have to acknowledge the somber news confirmed this week. The U.S. Army officially identified the four special operations soldiers who were tragically killed in that MH-60 Black Hawk helicopter crash near Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State. The crash itself happened back on September 17th.
These weren't just regular soldiers, right? They were from a specialized aviation unit.
That's correct. They were identified as Chief Warrant Officer 3 Andrew Cully, Chief Warrant Officer 2 Andrew Krause, Sergeant Donovan Scott, and Specialist Jadalyn Good. All four were members of the elite 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the unit known as the Night Stalkers. They specialize in difficult, high-risk helicopter operations, often at night. The Army says the crash is still under full investigation.
A real tragedy. Now, shifting to technology modernization, especially AI, it seems like the federal government is really leaning into AI now, partly maybe because of those workforce shortages we discussed, particularly in procurement.
Absolutely. Federal procurement, the whole process of buying goods and services, is under immense strain because the contracting workforce has been significantly reduced. This leads to delays, longer procurement administrative lead times, or pallet team. So AI is being pitched as a potential solution.
How can AI help in procurement?
The idea is to use AI to automate some of the more routine, time-consuming tasks. Things like processing bulk modifications. Imagine needing to update the same clause in thousands of existing contracts simultaneously. Or helping to draft initial versions of statements of work. The goal is to free up the human contracting officers to focus on the more complex, higher value parts of the job that require judgment and negotiation.
But using AI for something like procurement, the data it learns from has to be really reliable, right? You don't want biased or bad data leading to bad purchasing decisions.
That's critical. Agencies have to train these AI models using trusted, clean data sources, things like GSA's Official System of Award Management, or SAM. Companies involved in this space, like Unison, are helping agencies use AI tools for things like automated market research, scanning multiple vendor databases quickly to find potential suppliers. It's seen as a way to boost efficiency, especially during those frantic end-of-fiscal-year spending rushes.
And the intelligence community, they're facing their own data challenges that are pushing them towards AI.
Oh, definitely. The sheer volume of data they're dealing with now is overwhelming. The director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, Frank Whitworth, actually declared 2025 the year of AI for his agency.
Why this year specifically?
Because of what he called the data deluge coming from new sensors, especially new commercial and government satellites flooding them with imagery and other geospatial data. There's simply too much information for human analysts to process manually in a timely manner. AI is becoming a necessity just to make sense of it all.
But using AI in intelligence, especially for targeting or military applications, raises huge ethical and legal questions. How is NGA trying to manage that? They mentioned setting standards.
Right. They've set up an initiative called a game accreditation of GeoInt AI models. The goal is to create a process to ensure that the AI models they develop and use align with American values and, critically, the laws of armed conflict.
But they don't want this to slow down deployment, right?
Mm-hmm.
The usual government approval process, the authority to operate or ATO, can be really slow.
Exactly. That's the key challenge. A slow, bureaucratic ATO process doesn't work well for AI models that need to be updated and deployed rapidly, especially in active combatant commands or COCOMs. So Exame is trying to create a more agile system, maybe pushing accreditation down to the COCOM level itself, training people there to ensure models meet standards without creating a bottleneck back at headquarters. Trying to prevent, as Director Whitworth put it, hobby shops from deploying untested AI irresponsibly.
Fascinating. And finally, AI is even being used now to tackle one of the military's oldest and most expensive problems, finding the right recruits for really tough jobs.
Yes, particularly for roles with extremely high attrition rates, like Air Force Special Warfare, where historically 50, sometimes even 80% of trainees wash out. That's incredibly costly.
So how does AI help there?
Companies like R4 Technologies are using AI to analyze huge amounts of data from applicant profiles, sometimes millions of profiles, with thousands of data points each. The AI looks for complex patterns to better predict which individuals have the underlying attributes needed to succeed in these incredibly demanding pipelines. It's not making the decision, but providing decision intelligence to the human recruiters.
And the claimed benefit is reducing that washout rate.
That's the goal. By improving the selection process upfront, predicting who is genuinely suited and ready for the training, they hope to significantly lower those sky-high attrition rates, saving money and getting more qualified people into critical roles faster. Proponents also argue that using such a wide range of data points can actually reduce subjective human bias compared to traditional interviews or relying on just a few metrics, as long as you always keep that human in the loop for the final judgment call.
Okay, Sam, we've covered an immense amount of ground. Just looking back at everything since Monday morning, the Antifa order, the Tylenol advice, the potential overturning of Humphrey's executor, the H-1B fee, the EPA rollbacks, the Pentagon rules, the Fed debate, the congressional gridlock. Is there one single thread that pulls all of this together for you?
I think the dominant thread is the self-reinforcing cycle of executive assertion and the simultaneous erosion of checks and balances. You see the executive branch pushing highly ideological policies, often using executive orders or proclamations that rest on, let's say, contested legal ground.
Like the Antifa designation or the H-1B fee.
Exactly. Then you see the judiciary, or at least the Supreme Court majority, signaling a willingness to enable greater executive power by agreeing to reconsider longstanding precedents, like Humphrey's executor, and even acting preemptively, like with the FTC commissioner firing.
And meanwhile, Congress is stuck.
Meanwhile, the legislative branch is effectively paralyzed by gridlock, creating the political space, the vacuum, for the president to act unilaterally and portray the White House as the only part of government capable of making decisions. The challenges aren't being resolved through negotiation or legislation. They're being pushed through by executive fiat, potentially legitimized after the fact by the courts.
So the key takeaway for you listening to this isn't just about the specific policies themselves. They're almost symptoms, right? The bigger story is about these potential shifts in the fundamental structure of government power.
I think so. The individual policies are significant, of course, but the potentially more profound development is how the legal landscape itself might be changing to accommodate, even encourage, this consolidation of power in the executive, particularly over parts of the government designed to be independent.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for today. We've talked a lot about the potential threats to the Federal Reserve's independence, both from the Humphreys case and political pressure. So let's ask this. If the Fed does lose its operational independence, if its next interest rate decision feels driven by political calculation rather than economic data like Governor Mearen was arguing for, what's the immediate unavoidable consequence of that loss of credibility? How does that sudden uncertainty change everything we think we know about the path for economic recovery or stability?
That is indeed the multi-trillion-dollar question, isn't it? A lot to think about there.
Absolutely. Sam, thank you, as always, for helping us navigate this incredibly dense and, frankly, quite consequential period of federal news.
My pleasure, Alex. Always important to track these shifts.